I'd just like to introduce Professor Peter Shergold. Professor Shergold was the CEO in the Australian Public Service for 2 decades. That's no small achievement. He was Australia's most senior public administrator, serving as Secretary of the Department to both to the Prime Minister and Cabinet. He directly served 3 Prime Ministers and 8 ministries in both the Coalition and the Labor Government. He's actively involved in the not-for-profit sector and chair of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation, who I note there are several graduates here of today. If we were to need to reinforce the stage for a public service heavyweight, we'd probably have to do it for Peter, so I'd introduce you. Thank you, Peter.
Well, thank you, Craig, for that thoughtful introduction to country. Thank you, Philip, for your opening remarks, and I will pick up some of those themes in what I have to say. Thank you to the Cotton R&D Corporation and all the sponsors for putting on the Welcome to Narrabri firework display last night. It was exceptional, and it wasn't on the agenda for the day, so well done on that. I consider myself singularly fortunate. Not only that I was offered a job in Australia 38 years ago, but that for 20 years as a senior public servant, I got to see a lot of Australia. I suspect more than 99.9% of those people who have been born in this great country. And for that reason, I am particularly delighted to have the opportunity to talk today about the leadership necessary to sustain rural communities. In those 20 years in the public service, I was at various times CEO of ATSIC and head of the Department of Employment, and then of Education, and then, as you've heard, of PM&C. And that meant that I did a lot of work visiting Indigenous communities in remote areas of Australia, attending area consultative committees in rural communities, running job network sites and work for the Dole projects across Australia, and visiting schools and apprenticeship centres and vocational colleges and universities in countless towns. And I've got to say, it was that getting out and about and listening and learning that was what made my job in Canberra so endlessly stimulating. But in truth, I also found myself increasingly frustrated, even angered, by the state of rural and remote Australia. And that's why, on leaving the public service, I joined up with a group that produced a report identifying that Australia, remote and rural Australia, had so many of the qualities of a failed state. And that was a harsh way to put it. But what we was looking at was the low incomes and the high unemployment, inadequate infrastructure, poor level of government services, particularly in education and primary health and hospitals, financial insecurity of communities, in some cases perhaps unsustainability, and deteriorating community assets. And that's why, too, I was so delighted not only to head up the Centre for Social Impact, which is an attempt through 4 business schools, New South Wales, Swinburne, Melbourne and UWA in Perth, to teach socially responsible business management. So the Centre for Social Impact, I like to call it CSI Australia, because it increases the number of web hits we get from budding forensic pathologists. At CSI, our focus is on the management of not-for-profit organisations, new third sector social businesses, on community responsibility and accountability and social investment and social innovation. And I was pleased also to have this wonderful opportunity to be chair of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation, where the leadership programmes are designed to sustain resilient rural communities. I'm absolutely delighted at the number of fellows of the program and members of the network who are in the audience, when I did a quick count, and I think it's a conservative estimate, there are at least seven fellows who in various ways are speaking at this conference. And I suppose that bears testimony to the effectiveness of the Australian Rural Leadership Programme. So all of that, in a sense, I've got going for me, and yet I have to share with you that I am somewhat uneasy about this presentation. And the reason is that I'm not sure I know much about leadership. And this is now getting very worrying for those who paid my Aero Pelican flight. Let me share with you my one and only spiritual experience. Well, not so much spiritual, perhaps out-of-body experience. My dad was a sailor, and he didn't say much, but I knew he would have liked me to go to the Officer Academy, Dartmouth, in the United Kingdom. So I went to see if I could get in. I was 17. And I'm told by my colleagues in the military now that this leadership test still exists, much as it did 40 years ago. I was put in a gymnasium, a magnificent gymnasium, about this height. There were ropes hanging from the ceiling, and you were given a squad of five people, other 17-year-olds. And you were given two planks, four tyres, a length of rope, probably a sheet of barbed wire, I can't remember. And you were told that the floor was a raging torrent full of piranha, and you had to get your squad to the other side of the gymnasium without touching the floor. And then, as now, I was gung-ho, so with a tyre on each arm and the barbed wire in my mouth, the plank between my legs, I went swinging across the ropes. I got across the first rope, swung to the second. My squad were watching in disbelief. And it was then it happened. I had this out-of-body experience where I could see what I was doing. I could see myself hanging from the rope with the two tyres, the length of barbed wire and the plank. And I just started to laugh. And as you know, you shouldn't laugh. Of course, you laugh more. And I saw them all on their clipboards write, "No leadership qualities." And so that's why, thankfully for me, I didn't enter the Royal Navy. So, I stand before you exposed this morning, and you sit at this stage very, very worried indeed, as I try my hand, informed much more by experience and watchfulness than by academic text, try my hand to work out just what qualities of leadership are required to sustain rural communities. And I'm keen to listen to your response and talk to you over the course of the day. So consider this, if you will, as a conversation starter. Now, let me begin with context. What's the world in which rural leadership has to be exhibited? We know it's very complex. We know, we've already heard, that it is significantly changing. It's extraordinarily diverse. And what we often forget, it is often ambiguous. The challenges are wicked. I don't mean by that they are evil, but the fact that responses and solutions are neither clear, nor easy, nor unchallengeable. Indeed, the challenges of rural Australia necessarily involve a great deal of muddling through. Muddling through contested views in which few positions are categorically good or bad or correct or wrong. And it's complex not least because the futures are uncertain, necessarily requiring trade-off, necessarily involving the management of risk. And in part that's because beyond geographic location, it's remarkably difficult to define rural Australia. In that way, it's a bit like the not-for-profit sector. rural Australia, the not-for-profit sector, they slip off the tongue so easily. And yet both terms hide a diverse cacophony of different perspectives, expressed within an extraordinary heterogeneity of different communities, in which different interests compete for voice and power in economic and social settings, which are constantly evolving. I guess the one key element of commonality that I see is the character of the challenges that rural Australia face. Maybe there are many. I see five big ones. First, competitive pressures. Competitive pressures from international markets on production and viability. And not just from marketing pressures imposed by free trade, but also the range of regulatory barriers, most imposed by others, some imposed in Australia, that actually inhibit free trade. I see competitive pressures driven in part by the market power of consumer preference for organic food, for fair trade, for mulesing free wool, for halal meat, and unrelentingly, the purchasing power of retail oligopolies for cheaper production and distribution costs. The second thing I see in terms of the challenges facing the rural sector is, of course, the continuing contraction of the sector in terms of employment, if not economic value. Now, of course, the so-called rural decline is extraordinarily uneven. Some regional centres are booming. A smaller proportion of rural communities are doing well because they've got new agricultural products, or because of rising prices, or because of locational attractiveness to sea changes and tree changes, because perhaps of the benefits of non-agricultural activities such as forestry or mining or tourism. But of course, many other communities face the community sapping exodus of young people. Third quality in which leadership has to be revealed is in terms of the extraordinary environmental challenges. In part, the challenges which bear mute testimony to past production practices, and in part, reflecting changing weather patterns, most evocatively symbolised, of course, by the challenge of water, its distribution and its pricing, particularly in southeastern Australia. And these environmental challenges require changed agricultural practices, different produce, better resource use, and nearly always that most hard of attributes, greater investment. The fourth thing that I see, and which did increasingly frustrate me as a public service, is relative government neglect. The fact is, neither capital infrastructure nor the provision of publicly funded services is adequately maintained in most of rural Australia. And that's made worse, of course, by the withdrawal or decline of much of the supporting private sector of shops and banks. And the fifth quality of rural Australia, the fifth challenge, the fifth opportunity, perhaps, is the increasing social complexity of rural Australia. In general, it's true that youth are migrating to the cities and that rural Australia has a higher proportion of the elderly. But come on. Rural Australia is generations of traditional farmers, its new migrants and refugees from unexpected places, and its marginalised indigenous communities. Rural Australia is large graziers and struggling cockies and wealthy hobby farmers and urban life changers. Rural Australia is old industries, wool and beef and wheat, and struggling industries like rice and sugar and viticulture, and of course cotton. And newly emerging products such as aquaculture and sandalwood and alpacas and so on and so on. And each of the small communities is influenced by its very different hinterland. So leadership in these diverse communities with variable economic prospects is, let there be no mistake, hard yakka. And it requires tough leaders. It needs leaders who can exhibit, and I'm only going to use one piece of jargon in this address, who can exhibit contextual intelligence. Rural Australia is a world in which leadership needs to be informed by contextual intelligence. And context, says the textbook, is often real and perceived, psychological, social, physical and metaphysical. It can contain this grab bag of well-worn, left-leaning academic favourites, gender, attitude, values, symbols, cultures, personal ethics and so on. So what I mean by contextual intelligence is rather more straightforward. What I mean is that rural leaders need to grasp the significance of the past and its continuing and often unexpected relevance to the way we function today. It requires leaders who can be sensitive and responsive to the elements of economic, social, political, technological and demographic change, and how that influences present circumstance and future prospects. It requires leaders with an ability, above all, to translate yesterday's experience and today's change into a preferred tomorrow, and a capacity to see how context shapes the world in which leadership's going to have to be demonstrated. One thing seems pretty clear to me. If you have contextual intelligence, if you truly understand the complexity and the ambiguity of the values and perspectives of those who you're going to have to work with to build resilient rural communities, you're quickly going to realise that traditional displays of leadership behaviour are not going to be successful for very long over a range of issues. Using situational authority or social superiority to bluster or bully your way through may be successful in the short term, in limited circumstances, but not much beyond it. At the other end of the spectrum, sort of heroic, charismatic leadership to inspire is also, of itself, unlikely to bring success. Will not, in my view, deliver ongoing success. Because the context is too complex, the challenge is too profound, the terrain of decision-making much too contested for the power of one to be successful. To be able to contribute, and then to be able to contribute so you don't burn yourself out, requires a different sort of leader. A leader who can work with others to analyse the challenges, explore solutions, implement them successfully. Rural leaders don't just need contextual intelligence. They also, and I think this is distinctive, need whole of life leadership. And that's not a textbook aphorism, that's me. I think rural leaders need whole-of-life leadership. You see, what's always impressed me about Australia's rural communities is how true is the aphorism, if you want a job done well, then get hold of a busy person. And that truly is the case in rural Australia. Leaders in rural Australia cannot just define their leadership narrowly in terms of their work. Of course, leadership needs to be exhibited on the family farm, or as a self-employed builder, or retailer, or tourist operator, or as a professional teacher, or nurse, or doctor, or vet, or as a public servant, or as a researcher. Of course, that's important. But it's not enough. A rural leader, a leader for the rural community in which they live, has to be far more. A leader has to participate actively on the advocacy organisations that support their industry. They need to engage with the organisations that seek to sustain their town. Perhaps as a local government councillor, perhaps as a board member on the Community Improvement Association. They need to devote time to the not-for-profit organisations that give life and create a civil society for the community, whether it's Red Cross or Rotary or the Country Women's Association or the Parents and Citizens Association. I've always been wary of simplistic demarcations between work and life. You know, you need to balance work-life. What sort of person goes around able to differentiate work and life? It's beyond me. As if work is not crucial and a defining part of one's life and one's identity. But leadership in rural Australia almost always requires a willingness to get involved in that interwoven set of economic, social, political and cultural activities that gives meaning to community. And that's not the end of it. The bush is a different place. Community in rural life is rarely defined simply by the nearest village, town or regional centre. Community is defined by the agricultural geography of terrain and soil and vegetation and river network, which rarely fits the political boundaries of local government or state jurisdiction. And so it requires leadership that can create communities of shared economic and social interest. Leadership that requires boldness of vision, such as, for example, the Murray-Darling, that can drive a strategic intent that can overcome local self-interest and political demarcation that so often obstructs rural cohesion. Leadership, in short, has to be exhibited across the whole of life, in one's own business, in the local area, in one's industry sector, in regional groups and in community endeavour. It's leadership that needs to think global and act local, and that to a large extent is given voluntarily in a wide variety of unpaid ways. In a real sense, it's non-profit leadership, offering no direct personal reward, but with the potential to create beneficial social impact. So the men and women, the women and men, who bear these leadership activities need broad shoulders. I'd suggest five distinctive qualities, and here they are, as conversation starters. One, collegiality. You know, I have worked 20 years in academic life, I've worked another 20 years as a public servant. I'm actively engaged in the boards of large private sector companies and with not-for-profit organisations. And from my experience, here's my informed guess. Getting things done is often impeded by organisational territoriality and turf protection. Call them chimney stacks, call them silos. We all encounter the problem, whether it's within organisations or between organisations, especially when it runs across established administrative and political boundaries. And all of this turf protection is caught up in personal status and embedded often in a history of conflict. It's far, far, far too often impedes effective decision making. To get effective outcomes needs a leader who can bring together different people, different organisations, create a consensus and gain collective ownership of decisions. This is not leadership by authority or bullying. It's not leadership by inspirational speech. It's leadership of consensus by hard work. Personal charisma, situational authority will simply not get you so far. It needs someone who can empathise, who can stand in the shoes of those they're working with, who can treat all individuals with respect, who can see that a diversity of views is actually positive, who can create a team based together and bound together by a shared vision, who can actually get the power of collaboration. Now, to be honest with you, there is a danger, a big danger, and I have faced this myself in my life. There is a danger that some will seek to use this desire to create collegiality and collaboration, who will seek to use consultation and negotiation as a means to delay and to procrastinate. Very easy to use and abuse that goodwill. And so leaders do need to set out, well, what are the rules of participation? What is the timetable we're working to? Convince all participants that by working together, they can engender a cooperative creativity that gets outcomes that are far better than any single participant would have achieved on their own. Collegiality. Number two, execution. By which I mean not death, but implementation and delivery. You know, as I was brought up as a kid in rural England, in small country schools, and we were brought up on nursery rhymes and proverbs and mottos and riddles. And I can remember, some of you may even have heard this, you know, for want of a nail, a shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, a horse was lost. For want of a horse, a battle was lost. For want of a battle, a war was lost. For loss of a war, a country was lost. And all because of the loss of a nail. I can remember, you know, don't spoil a ship for a ha'porth of tar. A stitch in time saves nine, and so on and so on. All of them aiming to get across to young kids, as I was, that attention to detail was necessary in order to get things done well. Well, in more recent times, the management gurus have come along. You'll see there in the bookshop in Borders, don't sweat the small stuff. Well, I think you actually have to sweat the small stuff if you're serious about delivery. You know, the aim is, you know, well, a leader should think big picture, be conceptual, analytical, leave it to others to get out and implement. Well, I say poppycock and balderdash. My own view is that you cannot be a leader without the management skills and knowledge of how to get things done, how to bring them to closure, the human and financial and organisational risks, and especially project management. Big ideas, in my view, are nothing if they don't have a path to delivery. And leaders are undermined if they can't both articulate the outcome and make sure that it's achieved. You know, as head of the Australian Public Service, for the last 5 years, people got sick of me saying, look, I know all of you are interested in the sexy end of this job, you know, being involved with your ministers and developing policy. But it doesn't mean anything if you also don't focus on delivery of policy. I actually set up something called the Cabinet Implementation Unit to try and drive that implementation was important. And I have to say, in the last few months, if you look at the experience of home insulation or building the education revolution, you'd have to say, at least on that one, I was right. It's better, in my view, not to have a policy at all, not to have a vision at all, unless you can deliver on it. Because if you say you're going to do things and don't, all you do is feed scepticism and cynicism and community despair. And that leads to the third character I think you need as a leader in rural Australia, persistence. Implementation often requires leaders who can persist. The inspiration is good, the perspiration is vital. True leadership requires people who can exhibit both. Today I think it's often called resilience. Myself, I favour the 19th century term, doggedness. Doggedness. Thackeray has this wonderful quote in one of his novels where he says, it's dogged as does it, it ain't thinking about it. In other words, get out there and actually do it. And do it day in, day out. I've met people who are always up to date on the latest management mantras from the gurus of the boardroom. And at one level, that's good. It means that they realise that you've got to constantly change. But I've also met a fair proportion of those people who espouse enthusiastically the latest approaches. Oh, we've got to move to matrix management. Oh, we've got to have team-based structures. Oh, we've got to really focus on emotional intelligence. But then who move on to some new management fad before the first one is made fully effective. So in my view, you need dogged leaders, able to learn from mistakes and then keep on keeping on. Fourth quality, I think, is authenticity. As I've said, in rural life, family and work and community are inextricably interlinked. More, I think, than in our metropolitan centres. And yet there's often a tendency for leaders to try and keep their separate organisational lives distinct. Now, of course, you don't want Kerry Ann coming into work and spending endless hours talking about the problems she's having with her boyfriend. But nor do you want people who don't value, leaders who don't value what people can contribute from the wholeness of their life. And who then leaders who can harness that authenticity to get better informed outcomes driven by higher levels of commitment. I remember once we were having this discussion in the public service, a discussion held many times before and many times since on the problems of aged care and the distribution between the Commonwealth and the state and the role of local government, and we were all talking, and then someone, it was actually one of the more junior people there, a young woman, who said, "Let me tell you that the problem I've had trying to find suitable support for my mother who's got dementia." And you know, at that point, everybody started to bring in their personal stories. And out of that came, in my view, a much better understanding and commitment to the policy changes that we were bringing about. I'm not saying here leadership is about making decisions by anecdote. I am saying informed decisions by experience. And fifth and finally, I think, as a quality we need, is pride. I hope that I'm not the only failing father here who's often been frustrated in the past by the inarticulate, self-deprecating, unmotivated language so often favoured by our children. How's school today? Okay. And your new teacher? All right. So, how was netball or football practice? Oh, fine. Homework tonight? Suppose so. You know, it sort of makes Homer Simpson seem like an inspired orator. And don't you, well, I do get this urge to shake them out of that acquired inertia and just to get a wow or cool or sick or even a no problem that seems to suggest some modicum of passion and some level of life-affirming energy. And so I think people in leadership positions often fail to exhibit why they are committed, why they care about new agricultural practices or emerging market opportunities or animal welfare or good environmental practice or addressing community disadvantage. You know, I understand that some people are not entirely comfortable with exhibiting enthusiasm, tend to be more introspective, wary of exposing themselves, need to find a different style. But in truth, I don't think you can truly be a rural leader unless you're able to convey from your leadership a pride in community, in where you live and what you do and those who support you. So there you are, collegiality, execution, authenticity, persistence and pride. Those to me are essential ingredients for rural leadership. I hope they fired some of your buttons. I'm very happy if you disagree with them, and I look forward to a conversation on them over the course of the day.
Thank you very much, Peter. We've got time for one, maybe two questions from the floor. Does anybody have a quick question? Barb.
Thank you very much. I would just be curious to know who you would identify as doing Lynchy well in regional rural.
I think leadership is done well, not by organisations, but in a real sense by individuals. And in truth, and I say this with some caution, given that I'm the chair of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation, I think you can't just go out and teach leadership. I mean, it would be no good for me to go and talk to a group of students and say, these are the five qualities of leadership, now go out and implement them. I mean, it doesn't work like that. I think you can learn leadership. To a very large extent, you learn it from actually having organisations that can think, get you to think about what is required, but then seeing others who you can learn from, either good or bad, in how people are actually walking the talk of leadership. I think those that are doing it best, and there are a number of these organisations that are represented in this room, are those that look beyond, you know, narrow definitions of the problem at hand. I mean, at one level, when I think of, you know, the enormous problems with, you know, water allocation in Murray-Darling, for example, if all we had to worry about was water rights and trading and irrigation, this would be really quite simple. We could have an argument around here for a few hours, but we'd get the broad structures right. What makes it complicated, of course, is that that's not what it's about. It's about human beings. And so you've got to have, as Philip was saying, the leadership which can deal with those social and community issues at the same time they're dealing with the economic ones. That's the sort of leadership I think is required. And those that now start to articulate their vision of leadership in that way, I think, are much stronger organisations. I think it's very positive, for example, that the Cotton R&D Corporation and CRC and so on are now seeing that as equally important to achieving outcomes, that human dimension, as, if you like, the economic and technical aspects.
One last question for Peter. Donna?
It seems to me that leadership you're describing is very good concept of leadership. I'm just wondering if you think it works as well, or can it work as well in big bureaucracies as it can in small communities?
Well, yes, I think it can, and of course the truth is that I've had much more experience of trying to lead in big bureaucracies than in small communities. In some ways, I think big bureaucracies are easier, because although the demarcations and silos of territorial protection are high, and although you often have too much that is dependent upon hierarchical structure, it is relatively easy, in my view, to find ways of trying to bring a whole-of-government approach. The difficulty you have is where the challenge you face is not within one organisation or even set of organisations, but crosses, you know, political demarcations, for example, or means different communities working together. That, in my view, is a much harder quality of leadership, and calls for this ability to create a vision of collegiality in a much stronger way, to get those you're working with through your leadership to actually understand that you are working to a common end. And it will require compromises, and it will require taking some risks and moving forward. The one thing I didn't mention in this regard, which I'm becoming increasingly dubious about, is this newfound dedication to evidence-based policy. I've got to say that I think, to some extent, it's a load of old cobblers, because you can only do so much through the collection of evidence. Of course, in an organisation which you're talking about, which is trying to bring communities together across demarcations, you know, of course you need to collect evidence on the issue which is to be addressed. But in my experience, and I see it particularly in not-for-profit organisations, the evidence doesn't necessarily lead to the outcomes you want, or the evidence is such that you are deterred by the risks in terms of having a vision. It often seems to me that you've got to have more than evidence, collect the evidence, but then be willing to go beyond the evidence and manage the risk, because it's the only way to move forward. That's why, in my view, it's often not-for-profit organisations that are willing to be socially innovative. It is nearly always governments that are risk-averse. And what I want is a rural leadership that can go beyond that risk aversion and bring people in a collegiate fashion to take decisions that have risks that actually go into a brighter future. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Peter. There are so many things there which I've scratched down some notes. I'm going to have to talk to you a bit later on about some things. So no doubt Peter will be about today. So if you get the opportunity to corner him over a cup of tea, please do.